Welcome to New Lens with Comma Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within the different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Comma Good Capital. Today, we're here with Dave Clark. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm Dave Clark, CEO of Promising People.
Normally, I give a bunch of background on individuals, maybe not a bunch, but I definitely give some. But I'm going to set the stage differently here, just out of full transparency. So I have invested a small amount of capital into Promising People, what you are doing.
Thank you.
And well, we're grateful to be a part of it. And you'll learn more about what Promising People does and who they are. We've gotten to know each other over the last, what is it, 9 months, a year?
It's actually, I think we met for the first time 14 months ago.
Interesting.
It seems so. It seems like it's a short period of time, but yeah.
You will all enjoy hearing not only what Dave does, but some of his own story. And we specifically want guests on here who don't just talk about doing stuff, but actually do it. And you're doing it.
It's been a interesting journey. I mean, my background, I was born in South Carolina, raised here in Orlando, Florida. My father was an engineer at Martin Marietta at the time, now Martin Lockheed. I went to Lake Silver Elementary School here in Orlando, Edgewater, Robert E. Lee Junior High School. Now it's some other name now, but it was Robert E. Lee. And University of Central Florida, where I graduated from in 1979. I spent most of my life building things. I went through two financial collapses. I went through the savings and loan collapse when the commercial real estate market failed. That took my company down at that time. We rebuilt ourselves by acquiring assets from the failed institutions, rebuilt a very successful development company. And I ran that for about 15 years with the primary investor being the Rosen family out of New York. And then I launched my own enterprise, K-Clubs, and built a very successful resort and marina development company that was going public in 2007. And instead of going public, I got caught in the collapse of the real estate market. That led me to a whole new journey. We went to all of our partners, investors, and everybody else that was part of K-Clubs at that time, unwound the company. I made as many people whole as I could and kept a couple hundred thousand bucks to start my life over, and then built a chain of trade shops across the Caribbean with my son-in-law and my wife. We created, 30 stores in 9 different countries. And then that was exited successfully by my partners in that business last year. And along the way, because of what happened with my company collapse in 2007, what ensued was an SEC investigation. They civilly charged me in January of 2013 after 6 years of me cooperating with them. I fought that lawsuit and won. They appealed it. I fought the appeal and won. Then they charged me with bank fraud. My wife and I were both arrested. They arrested my wife to use as a tool to get a plea out of me. And she spent 14 months detained in a prison along with me until our first trial. Our first trial, she was fully acquitted. I wasn't convicted of anything. I had a hung jury. And they took me back to trial a second time, got a conviction on essentially me giving down payment money to 3 of my family members to buy 3 condominiums, which they said was bank fraud. It is not bank fraud, but they blocked all the testimony of my lawyers, my accountants, the expert witnesses. So we couldn't get the message to the jury that this was not bank fraud. So I was convicted of a single victim crime, alleged crime, of giving down payment assistance to three family members, one victim bank, which was Chase Bank, that never sued me for anything, and no loss on the transaction. So it carried a guideline sentence of 0 to 6 months. The judge is allowed in our country to ignore the jury verdict. And so he took what the jury unanimously found me not guilty of and enhanced my sentence to 40 years. Mm-hmm. So I spent 6.5 years in federal prison fighting my case based on a sentence on what I was found not guilty of.
Let's fast forward here only because I want people to understand that about you.
Right.
You have radically used this as an opportunity to do amazingly good things. So, but tell us this, how did you, and you don't have to go through all the details, how'd you get out?
President Trump commuted my sentence on January 13th of 2021. Mm. A lot of my family members and prior partners put together a very good presentation to tell my story. They got it to him along with a video of the impact that has had, on our family and our life, but also about Promising People, which is the new company that, I founded and I'm running now to address these issues for this forgotten population of people that are incarcerated. My passion is to assist these people that have been locked away from society, separated from their loved ones, and are not getting any of the tools they need to rebuild those connections and maintain those connections. So our country has a massive recidivism problem. Everybody has heard the statistics, but we've got 5% of the world's population and 25% of the incarcerated population. We have a very, very broken system of justice in our country. And the only way to change outcomes is to have a holistic approach to rebuild the connections and maintain the connections, but also educate people. So to give them skills and training and support that will enable them when they are let out to make a life change. And we have so many groups in our country that want to support that effort. We're literally thousands of nonprofits that are dedicated to help people that are going through the justice system. And our company is a faith-based company. We believe that our faith is the most central part of a person being able to maintain hope when they're going through sometimes decades of separation from normal society. So we're centered around our faith, but we've created technology that can maintain those connective things that are necessary for a person to successfully reenter society.
If you don't mind, I want you to articulate on the word connection and what you mean by that. I just came back from Parchman Prison in Mississippi, and I got to witness a funeral inside of prison. I got to go to a geriatric area. I got to go to a hospital. I think I got a sense of when you say connection, plus I've been doing this for a long time, but help our listeners. What do you mean by connection?
We are human beings that need to feel the support of our family, of our friends, of our loved ones, of our spouse, our children, in order to maintain mental health, right? And so when people are separated radically and quickly from all of those connections, you go through a series of trauma, right? Mentally, you go through a series of trauma that, breaks down your hope. I don't really know how to adequately describe how that feels. You were you're living your life, you've got all your loved ones around you, you're, you know, even if you're doing things that are wrong, everybody has a social network, everybody has, you know, a connection. And then you're drug out of that and you're placed into a situation where you don't know anybody. And it's not a friendly environment. It's harsh. It's just horrible. So people try and maintain their connections by phone calls, you know, or emails. But in the prison space, that's limited. And a lot of the people that are there are indigent. They don't have resources. They don't have money. And these things cost money because they're charged for them. That's one of the big controversies in society is the rate that people have had to pay for phone calls, for access to emails and things like that. Those costs are coming down now, and that's good because of advocacy. Those forms of connection, writing letters, it just is not. It's not, it doesn't work.
What do you say to the person who probably never been to a prison, never really interacted, when they say, yeah, but these guys, they did something wrong. So, you know what? Let them sit in there and not have connection. From you being around them, what would you say to that?
The reality is I wish everyone could go to a prison, you know, just to experience the people that are there. You know, I was raised in a family with a mom and a dad that loved each other and were educated and provided me opportunities. And all of those things were central to my life. But the 90% of the men and women that are in prison did not have any of that. In the men's facilities where I was at, one a high-level security penitentiary, and the other, a medium security facility, 90% of the men there had no connection to at least one of their parents. Mm. So, I mean, and I'm talking from either birth or shortly after birth. So they were raised in circumstances. I mean, I, as a white male businessman, I was by far the minority in the population. I quickly developed friendships because I wanted to, number one, figure out how can I stay safe and fit into this new environment I'm thrust into. But number two, I wanted to understand what was happening. I mean, I was raised by a father and mother that spent 40 years going into prisons here in the Orange County Jail Ministry here, right here in Orlando. My father founded that and spent, when he wasn't working as an engineer at Martin, he and mom were down at the jail trying to help prisoners, right? Male or female. And it was their life's commitment. I mean, that was what they did their entire life. I hired a lot of the people and did, spent them, but it wasn't a mission that I really supported. And now I'm thrust into the environment. I mean, it was, you know, it's like God has different ways of getting your attention sometimes. Usually he tries to strip away the things that are keeping you from hearing his voice. And so I had those things stripped away in a very real way.
I want to get to promising people, but I want to say one comment on the connection, because it just happened 3 days ago, 2 days ago for us. And so I said I witnessed a funeral inside of this prison. And so we were in the chapel. This is a very unique prison because it's actually 1,800 acres. So there are multiple buildings all over the place. And some of the freedoms that they give these guys is not normal. So anyways, there were probably, I'm going to guess, between the group that I was with and then some of the inmates, maybe there was 10, 15 people. They had a casket up front. They had the band playing worship music. They had a picture of him up there. They gave a little message, and then two or three inmates shared about this man. And you realize how important even just that funeral for this guy. Obviously, the guy, he's dead. But for the culture of those men who were there,
there's, yes, this guy had done stuff wrong, but there was a dignity even in death. And I guarantee you that little act permeates through that prison in a positive way of, look, life, there's dignity in, yeah, in life, even if you've done something horrible.
I can relate to that story and that pain. My father passed away while I was in prison. I did not get to go to his funeral. And I can't imagine, you know, anything. And this was pre-trial, right? I mean, how do you justify not letting somebody go to their father's funeral, right? So that's the harshness of the system. And the having someone, a warden, a facility that will allow that is amazing. I've got so many stories that are embedded in my mind now that, you know, we could spend, you know, the next 2 days, yeah, talking about the painful things. But the real question you want to know is how do we create connectivity in an environment where you're separated? And that's the wonderful thing about where we're at today in our society. They've created technology that gives you the ability to do that, but in a real and more personal way. And it's virtual reality, right? And it's so when I went through and quit feeling sorry for myself, right? And began
that. That's I would love to spend an hour on that, but we won't.
Yeah. Yeah. But I quit feeling sorry for myself. That's when Promising People was born in prison where I was at, after talking with, studying, looking at the real root of the problems and seeing that virtual reality had a way to recreate those connections. And so Promising People, we started creating products that would allow us to train people, to support people from a mental health perspective, to give them soft skills so that when they, when you take somebody that did something horribly wrong, they're getting out. 95% of the men, right, they're getting out. Whether we think they're getting out. They're coming back into society. You take a person that's been gone for 2 decades, hasn't no real connection to technology, no education, no training, and we put them back into society. What do you think is going to happen?
Right? Mm-hmm.
We have to give these guys transition. And transition means a broad base of support. You have to train them skills so they can get a job. But you also have to show them what's happened in the world since they've been gone and get them reintegrated with the technology. These people have medical issues and things. They need to have a seamless transition there. They've got addiction issues. They've got mental health issues. That's the biggest things in, you know, getting somebody functional again is to deal with the trauma. I mean, it is just like going in prison for an extended period of time is like going to war. You know, you are in a hostile environment that you cannot feel safe, comfortable at all for the time that you're there. And so they are dealing with paranoia, all kinds of things. And we have tools now that can reconnect men and women and do it effectively to all of these critical things that are barriers to them successfully reentering society. So,
why don't you give us a very tangible example so people can understand, and let's just stay in one vertical. Let's stay in Promising People, the virtual reality trades training. Can you explain to us, how does that vertical work? Why is it going to work with the Pell Grant? And then what would an inmate actually experience if they were able to go through some of these courses?
So we've been piloting our products now for the last year, both in prison setting and non-prison settings, so that we can show people the efficacy of the product. Everybody that has done any research into virtual reality and the headset method of doing anything, we all know this. We know that when you put content in a headset and put it on a person, it is more effective in people's retention of what they were shown in the headset. And the statistics around that and the studies around that are incredible, almost unbelievable. So they did a study at the Baptist Health Hospital about basic tasks related to the medical field. And they took a cohort and put them in a traditional classroom setting, had a teacher deliver the training. And what they were measuring at the end of the study is how much material did they remember that they were taught in that setting and for what length of time. And so in a traditional teaching setting, you got a teacher up front, he's got, you know, 20 men and women teaching them basic tasks. You know, they completed it and then they went back and started measuring, well, how much do they remember? They also did it with tablets, with a online look at a screen setting, similar thing. And then they did it with virtual reality. So in the teacher setting, the students remembered 20% of what they were taught for a week. After a week, they had forgotten 80%, right? In the tablet setting, same exact results. They remembered 20% of the material after a week. In the headset, they remembered 80% of the material. That's not the unbelievable part. That was after a year, not a week. And so the technology itself is what changes outcomes of retention. So what we did is we created training programs that teach basic skills, because 80% of the population in a prison setting are people that are out in halfway houses or on supervised release, or were precluded from accessing government funding back in 1994 when they made it people with a criminal record or any of these classes that I just mentioned are no longer eligible for Pell Grant funding. I think one of the best, I mean, if you can imagine a stupider policy, it's just the people that has the most need, right, to do something to change their lives were excluded for the last 30 years. Now they're eligible again. So there's a funding source. This technology we just completed with Tri-City Electric here in Orlando, teaching people the basic skills to be an electrical helper, right? We started 6 months ago with our first cohort, measured, you know, what was done, put them on the job to see how successful they were and all of that. And Tri-City helped us develop this electrical program that I'm speaking about. They were spending roughly 8 months training a brand new person that walks in their door that they hire that has no skills, no background in electrical, the typical way trades are trained. They put them on a job, give them a broom, a shovel, tell them to learn what they can from the superintendent, and gave them basic safety training and other things. But it would take them 8 months to get them to where they were up to a U.S. Department of Education framework of electrical helper or pre-apprentice electrician. Using our technology, we did it in 15 days. Okay, so that was 6 months ago. We just completed our second cohort, and we got a little bit more efficient in the way we delivered the training, and we did it in 10 days. From an industry perspective, these are people that, you know, obviously are, you know, not criminal backgrounds. They're just young people entering the trades. You know, we've proven now that this, just putting this training in a headset instead of doing it the traditional way, changes outcomes and shortens time frames, because the students remember what they were shown. It embeds it. So what a beautiful tool, right? You've got a tool now that you put on. And if you haven't ever put on a headset, you just got to go do it. I mean, because it is amazing Anybody that has not put an Oculus, well, we use Oculus, there are many different versions of them, but you've got to do it because it is so realistic. It is so personal. It is like you're with the human being that's in the headset with you.
And I can speak to, because you all have come over here to my house and I have done that multiple times. And just to give you a little snippet of it, if I can even articulate it, you basically have these two little wands. You've got your headset on, and then you're immersed in picking up tools, electrical tools, which ultimately they get those same electrical tools when they're done, right?
Right. Yep.
And you go over and do the task that is being told. And I don't know how to describe it until you go do it. You're in another reality. I mean, you're obviously here and present, but you're doing this with your hands in this virtual reality. And, you have to try. I mean, you have to try. I don't know how else to, it's really awkward. I don't know how you do describe it. I want to say one other thing because, so I, coming back from this prison in Mississippi, I asked an individual who was over all the programs for the Mississippi prisons. And I said, and actually somebody asked him a question. How can us outside, how do we best help inmates? And he was formerly incarcerated himself. His answer was transitional type support. It was exactly this. It was job training. It was as basic as helping them get a driver's license, all these kind of things. And so what you are doing is plugging into this and fundamentally a job training and a job so they can function and support their own. That's at the core of this.
Yeah.
So you know it, but I just heard it from the mouth of the guy and he's like, this is the number one thing we need. The other thing I'll say is in that specific prison, they had a school. Mm-hmm. So they had HVAC in that property where they were training. They had electrical. They had all that stuff. So I could compare and contrast and go, all right, you've got your 6-8 guys going through these programs. First of all, they had to have space for, and this is a very unique prison. So they had space for that at this prison. But talking to the guy, he's like, we don't have this at all of our prisons.
But how many people were in the prison you were at?
Oh, there was 2,500.
Okay. And how many of them were getting training?
In those, I mean, in each class, maybe there were 8 to 10.
Problem is, you know, we have a massive prison population, 10 million people a year, right, go through this. And the prisons were not designed to do this. It would take billions and billions of dollars to effectively train even 20% of the population. So 80% doing it the traditional way, right? So my dream is, my dream is...
Which is great. I was going to ask you that question. So go, I want to hear your dream.
Yeah, so my dream is that every single person that needs help in any of the areas that are transitional, right? It does it, but training, they can do it in their cell. Prisons go through lockdowns. We have COVID that shut down the city. You know, and when that happens, all connectivity stops. No visits. You're not even leaving the cell. You can't go to any. So these headsets, my dream is that a person, every person will have one in their cell so that they can maintain connectivity to their family, to the training that they need, to their mental health counseling, to the groups that are critical for human beings to stay connected. Visitation policies in prisons are important. That's how contraband, drugs, all kinds of things enter prisons, which they need to keep out. But the punitive nature of not allowing visitations to occur, you know, for all kinds of reasons, you know, keeps, once you break those family ties, it's a year, 2 years at the most, where the families just are not part of the incarcerated person's life anymore. And if you can imagine, right, so one of the things we're going to be doing in the U.S. Virgin Islands, where we're doing a lot of our pilots in the correctional space, is we're going to have headsets at public libraries, and inmates are going to have headsets in their cells, and family members will be able to go out, and then they can connect. They can watch a movie together. They can have their family playing a game, you know, but just maintaining, you know, that human contact. It's just.
And what's crazy is because I've experienced it until you put it on and experience it, you can't.
It sounds unrealistic, but I can tell you it is very realistic. And the really neat things that are happening now with realistic, look, these are avatars, but they're avatars that are you in that environment, right? But they're now, they look like you, they move like you. When you reach out your hand, you can feel the haptic handshake happening. You know, it is, you know, it's not the same as being there, but boy, it's so much better than, you know, anything else that's out
So there. When I was at the funeral, there was a guy behind me and I started talking to him. He was an inmate, and I asked him, do you have family? He says, absolutely. I said, when was the last time you saw your family? I don't remember the answer, but basically they've never seen me in here. And I said, well, do you talk to him? He says, every week. He says, but my mom doesn't want to come here and see me like this. And part of it's because the act of saying goodbye, knowing that he's staying there. And so she won't do it. Yeah. So it'll be interesting in this example, if she would experience it this way, I bet you it would be a deeper connection than on the phone, but yet not so painful as seeing in person. So it'd be interesting how that fits for her.
Well, it's also more private. I mean, by the nature of the device, you know, when you're a 40-year-old man, you don't really want people to know that you can't read or write or comprehend things, or how slow you're learning, or any of those things that put pressure on the education setting or any other type of setting. You have, you know, fear of people understanding your vulnerabilities or your lack of things. So the headsets, it does away with all of that. It's a private space. It's just you and whoever else is invited into that space. The rest of the world doesn't see it. And so once you're comfortable in that space, right, then you know you're having a private, you know, experience. And, you know, and also the beauty of this technology is you move at your own pace. You know, there's, you know, in a classroom setting, we've all been there, you know, there's a broad range of different student levels, right? And you've got a certain period of time to complete programming and to do it either successfully or failing. This technology allows people to move at their own pace and succeed. And when they succeed, we designed our programs, particularly the electrical program, to require 100% success in each lesson before they can move to the next lesson. But in the headset, you're not holding anybody back. The class isn't stopped because you're struggling with learning something. So everybody gets to 100% success. And just watching I know I'm rambling. I know, it just, I'm so excited about what we're seeing results wise now. But we had a man in the prison down in the Virgin Islands that is 59 years old. He had been there for more than two decades already. And he's a very kind man. And the education and other staff there at the prison was just, they loved this man, right? And they came to us and they said, Dave, we've got this gentleman and we have not been able to do anything to help him. He can't read. He's got severe dyslexia and he's on the spectrum. And so he's rigid in the way he moves and whatnot. And they said, will you try? And he goes, I know this isn't the candidate that you're really looking for. You know, he's not getting out probably ever. But he's so kind and he's so helpful. So we put the headset on him and we coached him on how to do it. And he passed five lessons in a week at 100% successful. And the women and men, and I'm talking officers. These are officers that, you know, normally they don't connect to the population. I mean, it's, you know, and I'm watching these people are just crying because they're seeing for the first time a technology that's able to overcome the problems that they, you know, were delivering. So he, you know, he can't read, but he can take his little handheld pointer and point to the word and it will reread the questions to him. And if he doesn't understand the word, we can explain the word to him. And so he just learned for the first time.
In closing, just relaying one other thing, and I've known this and you know this. So you can find different stats, but let's just say on average, and I'm sure this number is low today, they say it's $40,000 to $50,000 a year to house a man or woman in a prison. And yet when asked, when these guys get released, do they get any money? Have they saved any money? And the basic answer is no. And that's one of the challenges. I mean, these guys are behind bars making 35 cents an hour. There's no way they can save any money. And then they get out and he said, in theory, they're supposed to get $150 in theory, but they really don't. And so you see that this Pell Grant, which probably couldn't find a better use for it, plus the technology, man, if we can get this in the hands of these men and women before they get released, or frankly, even once they are released, I mean, it could unlock huge human potential.
Everybody measures recidivism in different ways. They say, well, you know, our state has 30% or 20% in 2 years or three. There's been one long-term study done, 9 years, right? And it's almost 100%. Almost 100% go back to prison. And in this study, it was 83%. Were relocked up in the 9 year time frame that they, and then you've got 17% left. And how many of those people just hadn't gotten caught yet? Or how many of those people aged out of the ability to commit a crime? And so the system is so severely broken that we have to force our way in with technology if we're going to move the needle, because of all of the investment that it takes to create different ways to train, teach, and help people that are incarcerated, the headset is the only solution. Scalable. No other solution can move the needle to serve enough people effectively to move the needle. And so that's the only way.
Well, we appreciate you coming on. We appreciate your vulnerability. I am sure it's not fun to, I mean, it's fun to talk about promising people, probably not fun to talk about how you got there, yeah. But I appreciate that vulnerability and sharing with us.
No, it's, you know, look, it's, everybody's got a life story. That's part of my story. End of the day, I thank God that he let me go through this because I'm now what I do with my remaining productive years. To have meaning and purpose, and promising people is meaningful and purposeful. So,
no, absolutely. Well, thank you. And don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. Please rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on a path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. Till next time, I'm Jeff Schaefer. Dave, anything you want to say in closing?
Thank you for the opportunity to share this. Thank you.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.